Please silence all electronic devices.
The biggest power of television for me as an investigative journalist is I get to show people either dodging my questions or alternatively I get to show people, you know, equivocating or hesitating as I'm asking them a question on camera.
Fill in the blank. The year is 2040 and Nick Oxner is running for what?
In 2040?
Yeah.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Fourth Estate Bunker of Truth on West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, it is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for clicking play and joining us for another long-form conversation. Your guest today is Chief Investigative Reporter with WBTV. That's out of Charlotte, Nick Oxner. Welcome to the podcast, man.
Hello, and thanks for getting my last name correct. 10 points for you.
See if I do it throughout the podcast. Pressure is now obvious. State lawmakers have adjourned until late April. No new state budget or teacher raises or any modicum of Medicaid expansion movement. But they did do one notable thing before they departed, and that was unanimously, we should note, provide scholarship funding for many children of military veterans, specifically veterans who are deceased, disabled, combat, or prisoner of war missing in action. The scholarship program has been funded for years. However, there are now, unfortunately, more students eligible for the program. There also, as I just mentioned a moment ago, no new state budget. So that has previously created a bit of a shortfall. There have also been some problems with the program itself, some of which you have uncovered in your reporting. Tell us more about those problems.
So the initial problems that we started looking into in October centered around the fact that this year the scholarship just hadn't been paid, any of it, right? There are parts of the scholarship. There's your tuition part of the scholarship. There's the room and board allowance stipend that you get. And then there's some other fees that the scholarship covers. All of this is per statutes, right? And we found out in early to mid-October that just none of it had been paid for anybody. And that's a little later than usual-ish, right? So we did a first story about it, and we talked to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs Secretary Larry Hall. His agency administers the scholarship. And he said, look, we always pay. We always pay by the end of the semester. We're going to get this paid. Initially, there was some confusion, and what piqued my interest at first in this story is in September, DMVA had sent out a letter saying we can't pay the scholarship because we don't have a new budget, which is not true, according to fiscal research. As you noted, this has a recurring line item in the budget, and it had about $9.2 million recurring money. So I said, well, this is weird. But he said, don't worry, we're going to pay it. We'll get it paid. So flash forward to mid-November, and we're hearing the scholarship still hasn't been paid. DMVA said they were going to have paid it by now. We're closing it on finals at the end of the fall semester. So what's up? The week of Thanksgiving, the scholarship recipients, about 1,200 of them, give or take, receive a letter saying we're cutting your room and board allowance in half from – I'm using round figures because I'm a reporter, not a mathematician, from about $3,000 to $1,500 for both semesters. Comes right, literally days before Thanksgiving, right as students are starting to get into finals, right after a whole semester of school's done, and colleges had credited and sometimes cashed out to students the full amount already, the $3,000. So they were on the hook to pay that back. And so that's where we were as of late November. We did a second story about it. The bill that the General Assembly passed in its one-day session appropriated $2.4 million additional to fund the full amount of this scholarship. The tricky part here is there are the questions that remain twofold. One, it appears, and we know from records that we got from DMVA, that Secretary Hall and his staff had asked House Speaker Tim Moore and the Speaker's staff to appropriate this $2.4 million last year in 2019 during the legislative session, and those requests went unanswered. So we don't know why that money was never appropriated to begin with. It also is unclear why the governor's staff went ahead and sent out – they had a hand in writing the letter saying we're going to cut your stipend in half, even though 2 weeks later the governor turned around and ordered that the full amount be paid. And so this is a really interesting case where there's a little bit of bureaucracy mixed with a little bit of politics, and every person that I've talked to for the story cannot give me a straight answer.
From your perspective and the reporting you've done, does somebody bear the brunt of the blame on this?
This is an interesting story. So often when I'm doing a story in Raleigh, it feels like there's a definite, I don't want to say bad guy, but, you know, a definite person who's probably at fault for doing whatever I'm reporting, and then the other side of this, right? Well, this is a story that the more I peeled back, the more people we found who had done something that maybe they ought not have done, right? And so this was a case where almost everybody in state government at one point failed these families and these students, because remember, there was a 2 to 3 week period. Well, there was a whole semester where families weren't getting their money. Parents were having to pay for expenses out of their pockets unexpectedly, stuff like that.
Right.
And then there was a 2 or 3 week period where families were just thought they were going to be about $3,000 short on what they'd planned for the year. And I think sometimes bureaucrats and politicians forget that the things that they do in this town have a real-world impact, and that's certainly the case with this.
Turn to a personal component of this for you. This is a very personal story for you. You're a Gold Star son.
Mm-hmm.
Your dad, Sergeant First Class Jim Oxner, was killed in Afghanistan November 15th, 2005.
Mm-hmm.
His fourth tour serving his country when this happened. I will concede that it can be challenging sometimes to separate, you know, your personal experiences or your beliefs from stories that you cover as a journalist. However, this is a whole different challenge. How do you achieve or try to achieve objectivity and fairness with something that I imagine hits very close to home?
Sure. It hits extremely close to home. I was a scholarship recipient of this scholarship when I went to college. And in this particular – and I'll also say every person that I talked to for this story, I told that I received a scholarship and I told them why. I didn't say that on air publicly, but it's – and it's not a secret. People know.
Right. You've written about this.
Yeah.
You've tweeted about this.
Correct. Yep. And I'm proud of my father. I talk about my father all the time. Proud to be a Gold Star son. In this case, I don't think too many people – argue with the notion that this is a population, Gold Star families and Blue Star families, that deserve benefits, right? And so it wasn't that difficult to cover this story objectively because no one disagreed with the premise of what you know, of what should be done and what the right thing is here. And so from that perspective, I felt like obviously I'm more invested in helping this community, right? This to me just means a little bit more because of my relationship to the community, and I understand, you know, as much as anyone else the sacrifices that these families have made. And so really at the end of the day, with that background, I was happy to be able to help these families, right, that are really stuck in the middle of this situation now. But it didn't really weigh on the are we being fair and objective, because at the end of the day, everyone that I talked to all had the kind of same objective as to whatever the problem is, let's fix it.
Nick Oxner here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. Oxner.
Second time. You're 2 for 2 so far.
All right. You can follow him on Twitter, Nick Oxner, WBTV. It is NickOchsner. Did the radio guy misspell?
No, appreciate that. Good job.
Being in a Gold Star family, losing your dad, I have no experience with this, full disclosure. I imagine it's something you think about every day, if not every waking hour, or most every waking hour. How has it shaped your reporting or influenced your approach to journalism as you tell stories each day?
That's interesting. I don't know that I've ever contemplated that question before. Okay. I got into journalism totally on accident, actually. I start every day – probably a lot of people do this, but I start every day thinking, how can I make my dad proud? Has what I done today – would that make him proud, and would that honor him and the sacrifices that he's made? I also think it's a privilege to get to go to work every day as you do and use the First Amendment. Right, which is a constitutional right that we have only by the grace of men and women like my father and his comrades going and fighting for us and sacrificing for us. So I think that's great that I get to be able to do that, and I'm really honored to be able to do that. You know, it almost sets then a higher standard of, am I being fair? Am I searching for the truth? Am I doing what's right and just? And am I making my community and, you know, the place that I live and the places that I love, am I making it a better place? Because I didn't serve in the military, but this is, you know, a way that I can give back by helping people and by holding people accountable in my own way.
I swear I heard you just say you fell into journalism accidentally.
Yes.
Tell me how, because I missed it if you just told me how.
I did not just tell you how.
Okay.
So I originally thought I was going to work in politics. If you do a Google search about me, you'll see that I ran statewide political campaigns when I was in college. I went to college at Elon University. And so I was at Elon. The only person I knew on campus was a guy that I'd done high school debate with, and he did the student newscast at Elon. And he said, "Hey, I do the newscast my freshman year, first week that I'm on campus. Don't know anyone but this roommate that I just met." He said, "I do the student newscast. You should come do the student newscast." And I thought, I watch the news. That could be fun. And I ended up majoring in journalism because it was just so fun. And the March of my senior year, we had two alums come back 2 weeks in a row. And I said, "I'm not going to be a reporter." And said, "You must be a reporter." And here we are.
What statewide campaigns did you run or were you involved with?
I ran as campaign manager. I turned 19 during the campaign for a guy named Jack Sawyer, who no one's ever heard of, who ran against Elaine Marshall for Secretary of State. Jack was a Republican candidate for Secretary of State in 2008. And then I ran Barbara Jackson's campaign for North Carolina Supreme Court in 2010, along with Rick Elmore's reelection to the Court of Appeals, and worked with Anne Marie Calabria some as well. That was before I realized two things. One, I don't ever want to do that again. And two, I'm an old curmudgeon who hates all elected officials.
All of them?
In their own way. I also love all elected officials too. But, you know, I now have a skeptical view of literally anybody.
You noted several moments ago you were not in the military at any point.
Nope.
Is it something that you thought about before your dad's passing or afterward? Is it something you ever entertained seriously?
No, actually. And my dad always used to say, "Oh, you should go to a service academy. They're great schools. It's free. You know, you should go do that." And I always said, "Yeah, I don't think so." As my wife will tell you, I don't really accept authority very well.
I think that probably leads us I was having a back and forth with an editor, and I said, you know, Nick Oxner is coming on the podcast. And I said, you know, I'm gonna ask him about this bill that recently was approved, being a Gold Star son. I was like, I'm probably gonna ask him about his style. And this editor said, "Well, what's his style? I don't know who he is. How would you describe his style?" And I was like, "Ooh," I was like, "That's interesting." I thought, I've never described anybody's style to them before on the podcast, but I'm gonna take a crack at it, and I want you to tell me if this is fair or unfair, or what you would have meant. What is Nick Oxner's journalistic style? A reporter with an appetite for public records who brings an aggressive approach, unafraid to try to pin a subject down, with a video camera rolling, who rarely hesitates to threaten a lawsuit when he is not receiving what should legally be turned over.
I don't think I would disagree with any of that, and most of that's a compliment, so thank you.
You're welcome. What would you add to that, if anything, about your journalistic style?
I don't think there – I would add that I don't just threaten lawsuits. We bring a lot of lawsuits, too.
How many do you think?
We're probably closing in, if you take lawsuits and other non-lawsuit legal action, we're probably at about a dozen. Started when I was at Elon. That's really when I knew that I should be a reporter, is when I filed my first public records lawsuit. I said, all right.
I'm not going to use the word chase. I've heard people use the word chase with you. I don't think that's a totally fair word. But you have pursued people who have not stopped to ask your questions. One of them was Christy Jones, who is the chief of staff for, mm-hmm. for the governor. This clip, tell me what this is about, this DMV issue, and what it was about, and why you took that path.
So this clip, we'd done a series of reports about the DMV and a secret DMV office that was set up in the DMV headquarters where was this 2 summers ago now, where there were 3 and 4 hour lines at DMVs across the state, people having to, in August, right? July and August, some of the hottest months of the year, people waiting to go get their IDs. And this is real IDs becoming thing. People need to go get their real IDs. And we got a tip, and we ended up confirming that there was a room at the DMV headquarters where 1 week a month, if you're on a special list, if you're a state employee or a friend or family member of a state employee, you can go to that DMV office and get your real ID without having to wait a scheduled appointment in 15-minute increments. So we'd done some reporting on this. The DMV secretary refused to talk with us. And so Christy Jones was here at a legislative hearing. And we had questions that had still gone unanswered by the Cooper administration.
Here's a portion of that confrontation, August of 2018. Here's what this sounded like.
Now, sorry to have to do this. We've been trying to get a comment from your office. We've been trying to get the interview we were promised with DMV. And we've been trying to get a statement from the DOT Secretary, Jim Trogdon, about the secret DMV office. And yet no one will talk with us. Why won't the governor's office provide us an answer to that? Ma'am?
That's Nick Oxner, reporter at WBTV, and Christy Jones, chief of staff for Governor Roy Cooper. Back in August of 2018, you were trying to get some questions answered. You did not. If we were to have let that clip continue to run, she did not have anything to say to you, in the, at least in the video.
For your newspaper, maybe you can describe that. But I think the biggest power of television for me as an investigative journalist is I get to show people either dodging my questions, or alternatively, I get to show people, you know, equivocating or hesitating as I'm asking them a question on camera. And so in this case, we had the chief of staff to the governor who, you know, for all intents and purposes, helps run the day-to-day of state government, right? Certainly account, certainly oversight of the DMV. They hadn't answered our questions. And so we thought it was fair and appropriate to ask questions. She didn't answer them. But if you're not going to answer them, at the very least, the public is going to see what you look like when you're avoiding accountability. And that's what happens when we do those kinds of interviews.
How many times have you done that? Dozens? Hundreds?
Probably dozens is probably fair. I shouldn't have to do that, right? People should be willing to answer questions. That exchange and every other confrontation I do with the governor or anyone else, I hope the effect is that people know that I am serious about asking questions and that they have to be held accountable to the public.
Has there ever been a time that your approach, you regret the way you have gone about one of these confrontations or interactions?
Since I've been at WBTV, I don't think so. It's always a learning process, right? And so I've been doing these. I started in Lubbock, Texas, and I spent 2 years there, 2 years in Virginia. And so probably when I was young, right out of school, I probably did some things that I would not – that, you know, reporter Nick today would not do. But I am really fortunate to have great bosses, and I'm not just saying this to earn brownie points. I'm really
fortunate. They probably don't listen to public radio, so it's okay.
I'm really fortunate to have great bosses, and I had a news director, Dennis Milligan, who just retired a couple months ago, who'd been in the business for a long, long time, and they have forced me to be more intentional and to really think through what we're doing when we put together investigative stories. I mean, because I am an aggressive guy, right? That's right.
I didn't mean it as a pejorative.
Yeah,
that's right. I'm a bald guy. You're an aggressive guy. Yeah.
Both of those things are true.
Right.
And so I think the best reporters have good editors, good bosses, people keeping them in check, right? Because we're all human. So we need people asking, are we being fair? Is this the right time to do this? Is this the right way to do this? And so before I do almost any confrontation, before the confrontation comes on the table, before that, when that becomes a possibility, mm-hmm. I go to one of my bosses and I tell them what I plan to do and we talk about it. And sometimes they say, no, I don't think this one feels right. And most of the time they say, okay, if you think that's what, but they make me list through, here's what I've done, here's the story, here's why I think these are questions that the public deserves to see not answered. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a time since I've been at WBTV where I did a confrontation and thought, you know, we probably shouldn't have. And maybe there is one, but
it's not coming to you right now.
No, but I think I attribute that to the fact that we try to check ourselves before we get to that point.
Closest you've ever been to someone taking a swing at you? Not at the bar in one of those instances.
Yeah. We did a story. This is when I was in Norfolk, Virginia, and we were covering the case. It was a guilty plea of a Navy SEAL who had stolen military-grade weapons and was selling them on the internet.
Okay.
And there was nothing else going on that day. My boss said, go to federal court. You can't get cameras in federal court. So there's literally no video or any elements to this story except for this paper complaint. And I'm the only reporter there. And me and my photographer, I'm like, let's just wait outside. This isn't a confrontation. We'd call this more of a perp walk, right, in the TV news.
Right, speak. Right, absolutely.
And so let's just see if he comes out and let's see if we can get something. So 20 minutes after the thing ends, him and his wife walk out because I know now, I did not know at the time, they needed to get their credit cards so that they can pay the restitution he was ordered to pay as part of his sentence that day. So they're walking to the car. It's a half a block or so from the steps to their car across the street. And I'm peppering him with questions the entire time. And yet my dad was a Green Beret, so, you know, special operator. He was a Navy SEAL, special operation. You're an elite warrior. How are you betraying your country like this? What would your comrades say to that? So they get to the car, and the guy's wife had the keys, but she was so engrossed in watching me ask her husband questions that she's standing there and forgets to unlock the car. So the guy's just standing I'm peppering him with questions, and I thought I was going to get punched. I mean, I really thought he was going to take a swing at me. And finally he's like, unlock the car.
Oh, man. Oh, that's a tough day for him. Unlock the car.
We made good television that day. Oh, man. I mean, that's the added, I won't lie, right?
This is good TV that you do.
It is. It makes television out of some boring stuff, too. I'm really serious when I say all the other, you know, more high-minded reasons why we do confrontations like that. But, you know, yeah, we're also making good television. You know what is less good television? People sitting down and just answering my questions, which I would prefer happen.
You're a public records hawk. Yes. Tell me a change you would like to see in the public records law in North Carolina.
Where do I begin? We only have how long for this podcast?
Well, give me a couple in brief.
No, I'll tell you the biggest problem with public records in North Carolina. It's that the only mechanism in our law that allows us to enforce the Public Records Act is you have to take someone to court. And that is really expensive. It takes a very long time. And essentially, it allows an agency or a public official to totally stunt install your story. And it's very time consuming.
Is there a state that does it well?
Oh, sure. On this particular point, I started in Lubbock, Texas. Texas actually has a fantastic, fantastic system where when I make a records request to any government agency, if they want to deny my request or withhold any records or make redactions of any kind, they send it to the Public Records Office at the Attorney General's office, who reviews every denial and every redaction. And they either say, yes, this is appropriate, or they say, no, public agency, you have to give them the records. Your denial was improper here. And get this, if the public agency still persists in withholding the records, the state sues the agency.
Wow.
And to the point where I moved from Texas to Virginia. I got a call while I was working in Virginia from the AG's office that said, hey, just so you know, we're filing a lawsuit because this town still hadn't produced these records that I had requested.
Very interesting.
What a system.
We're going to go rapid fire here to conclude things. Which 2020 race is most intriguing to you in North Carolina?
That's a tough question. I think I'm interested to see how the Democratic Senate primary plays out, because I think Erica Smith Ingram's polling better than a lot of people expected her to. And then it'll be interesting to see who, between her and Kyle Cunningham, whoever wins, how that race comes down against Tom Tillis.
Your wife is a reporter for the Associated Press. Best thing about being married to a journalist?
We both work crazy hours and, generally speaking, both understand the crazy things that we have to do as reporters.
Your Twitter bio reads in part, quote, Nick would not know the truth if it bit him in the face, close quote. Who said that?
The then lawyer for the Union County Sheriff on the day he retired to my lawyer as we were handling a public records case against them.
So he did not say that with a smile or over a clink of the glass or anything like that. That was said in all seriousness.
In all seriousness, in an email about how terrible I was and how great the sheriff was. Let me just footnote that to say the suit ended by the sheriff producing hundreds of pages of text messages and paying $50,000 of my attorney's fees.
Fill in the blank. The year is 2040, and Nick Oxner is running for what?
In 2040?
Yeah.
Maybe governor.
Okay. What party?
I am serious when I say that since I've become a reporter, the fun part about being a reporter is I don't have to think about that anymore.
Hear, hear. Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter at WBTV in Charlotte. You can follow him on Twitter at Nick, N-I-C-K, Oxner, O-C-H-S-N-E-R, W-B-T-V. Thanks for coming on the podcast. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me down here in the Bunker of Truth.
As always, you can subscribe to the podcast, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify. Also, stay up to date with whatever is happening at your state legislature. Perhaps not a whole lot in the coming weeks, but you never know. So stay tuned to WUNC.org. For Nick, I'm Jeff. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again later this week when we review some of the state political news with Rob Schofield and Becky Gray.